Good morning. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Travis Smith, and I represent the appellant state of Minnesota in this sentencing appeal. While I understand that we are in Minnesota, where all the women are strong, all the men are good-looking, and all the children are above average, there is something seriously wrong with the sentencing system that says, on the one hand, that departures from the guidelines are discouraged and are intended to apply only to a small number of cases, but then turns around and grants downward dispositional departures in 42% of all cases where a defendant like respondent is convicted of being a felon in possession of firearm or an ammunition.
Well, that's not a factor the court relied on or even mentioned, counsel. He talked about the facts of this case, so I'm not really clear on what the nature of that argument or what other courts have done have to do with whether or not this judge abused his discretion.
That's correct. I'm not sure what it has to do with that either, but respondent has relied on that fact both in the district court and in their brief here. And I think it's an important consideration to bear in mind that we're talking about a system.
Did we reverse all those 42%? My hunch is we didn't.
I'm certain that so not all 42% were reversed.
Mr. Smith, is the argument? And look, the issue is not what any one of us would have done had we been the district court. I mean, maybe I wouldn't have given him a departure, but the issue, as Judge Flory accurately pointed out, is whether this was an abuse of discretion. So where's the abuse of discretion? Is it because he gave a non-offender or offense-based grounds for the departure? I mean, where's the error that we need to reverse, sir?
Correct. And there are three major errors here.
Okay.
The first is concluding that a defendant who commits multiple felony offenses well on felony probation is exceptionally amenable to probation. The district court is the state's position.
Particularly amenable. So you would agree he did say the magic words?
He did say the magic words.
Okay.
But the state's position is that the entire record here demonstrates that that finding was an abuse of discretion.
Okay.
The second error is that the district court concluded that this particular offense was less onerous than the usual offense without an adequate record.
Now, let's say for the sake of argument would you agree that and I understand you don't, but if that grounds is supported by the record, that would be an adequate basis for departure?
No, I disagree.
Okay. Why?
Because I believe as a matter of law, it is inappropriate to grant dispositional departures based on offense-related factors.
That's not what was said in a published opinion by this court, though, in 2018 in the Walker case, where it said that the posture was different because there the court denied the dispositional departure, but this court said that a district court may consider both offender and offense-related factors in a published opinion, which is precedential for us.
I think that statement in Walker, like the statements in Bell, which it relies upon, and the Supreme Court statement in Choklos, are dicta. None of those cases directly involve the question of granting a dispositional departure based on offense-related factors.
Is it a different analysis for granting as opposed to denying dispositional departures on offense-related factors? It seems like if you can consider them for one, you should be able to consider them for both.
I believe that the analysis is always different depending on whether the district court granted or denied a departure. Because
it's the same abuse of discretion standard, isn't it?
It is not.
How so?
Because the presumptive sentence is always a legal option, and therefore it is only in exceptional, rare cases that the district court's decision not to grant a departure one way or another will be interfered with on appeal. It requires something. It's essentially a heightened abuse of discretion standard, is the way the case law clearly reads. And if you look at Kindem.
Have they used those words? Heightened abuse of discretion standard?
They haven't used the heightened abuse of discretion standard, but if you look at the Supreme Court decisions in Kindem or Birch, they say effectively that, well, the district court's decision not to depart is an appealable order. It is only in rare cases where the appellate courts will interfere with a decision not to depart. That language is used specifically in those cases where the district court has refused to depart. And I think I know it's an unpublished decision, but in State v. Herbert, 2014 decision by this court pointed out that decisions involving the district court refusing to depart and decisions involving the granting of a departure are not apposite to one another. They do not proceed according to the same analysis. And accordingly, it is different. Practically speaking, it's different. And the Supreme Court and this court have treated them that way.
So I take it then, would you agree, Mr. Smith, that if the record supported grounds for an offender-related departure dispositionally, that would be permissible?
Yes.
Okay. So what's wrong then with what the district court said, if I can find it? First of all, the PSA recommended a departure, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So presumably the people who are most familiar with dealing with offenders, you know, and I realize you're not bound by that, but, you know, they took a pass at this guy and thought, yep, he, you know, is a good risk for probation. Would that be a fair statement?
That would be a fair statement.
So then the court looks at, I can't seem to find it, but as I seem to recall, it looked at his, he's 47 years old, his criminal history was older, he complied with a CHIPS protection, he's maintained his sobriety, I guess he was unemployed, he's done some, he had approximately 4 months of clean drug tests, completed an anger management program, two domestic violence classes, that doesn't sound like a lot, I think they're usually 12, but he's done some stuff. And then the court said, based on all that, he's particularly amenable to probation. So why isn't what I've just articulated not provide record support for the court's determination of a departure under the sentencing guidelines?
A couple of reasons.
Okay.
First, again, the district court completely ignored, didn't even mention the fact that the defendant committed these offenses while he was on felony probation.
Because God knows that never happens in Minnesota. Everybody complies with probation and no one ever gets a new felony. I mean, I don't know what happens in your county, but in Hennepin, I can tell you lots of times I was giving new probation on somebody who had a felony conviction. And, you know, maybe that's just Hennepin County, but it seems to me if the Sentencing Guidelines Commission under Justice Steetson and Judge Shellhouse, if they wanted to pass a law that says, you know what, if you're on felony probation and you pick up a new felony, automatic, you know, you get whatever the guidelines, that's not a ground for departure. But they haven't, and therefore it seems like just because you pick up a new felony while you're on felony probation, that doesn't bar another downward dispositional departure, does it?
It doesn't as a matter of law.
Okay.
What's the problem here? That the district court didn't explain why that wasn't a disqualifying factor? I mean, it was noted in the PSI, and you're not disputing the fact that the district court was aware of his probation status.
It certainly seems like the district court should have been aware of his probationary status. It didn't make any indication that it was. It didn't make any indication that it considered that. And I think that's troubling on its face.
Is there a legal requirement that a district court spell out with that level of detail?
I don't know that there's a legal requirement that they spell out, that the district court spell out that level of detail, and I'm not here advocating for that. What I'm saying is that in light of Soto and the fact that the Supreme Court says when it means particularly amenable to probation, it really means that you have to be exceptional. I think not considering that factor and not weighing the fact that the defendant was on probation heavily in the consideration as to whether to grant a dispositional departure on the basis of particularly amenable to probation demonstrates an abuse of discretion. You have to be exceptional. You have to stand out amongst the class of offenders. And I understand that people who are in felony probation pick up new felonies and get put on probation on a regular basis throughout the district courts of Minnesota.
But I would guess that it's the rare person among that group who is able to deal with a child protection matter and meet the requirements to get the child out of the system within a year, and that included maintaining sobriety and doing other things. I mean...
And I think at that point in time, we're drawing the class too small. The class of offenders now we've drawn to people who are on felony and probation who commit new offenses that are commits, and then have CHIPS cases. So you get a case that's a sample size that's so small that the defendant is always going to stand out. And that's not appropriate. It's not appropriate in a system where departures are supposed to be rare, where the presumed sentence, the legislatively commanded mandatory minimum sentence, which the district court may depart from, is a commitment to the Commissioner of Corrections for 5 years. This isn't just any felony. This is a felony that the legislature has deemed is subject to a mandatory minimum sentence. It's a felony committed by a violent offender, by a defendant who has a history of committing violent crimes, from burglary to assault to possession of significant quantities of marijuana to now possession of ammunition.
One shotgun with an explanation of how it ended up in the shed. I mean, why is the district court abusing its discretion when it considers those circumstances?
The reason I think the district court is abusing its discretion when it considers the fact that it's one shotgun shell with at least a plausible explanation for how it ended up there is the fact that there's no comparison. The factor of less onerous than the usual offense necessarily demands a comparison. There has to be a denominator. And the district court...
And a district court judge who's been doing the job needs to explain that in a departure report or on the record?
I believe so, because otherwise there's no opportunity for a meaningful appellate review. There's no opportunity to subject that decision to any level of scrutiny. And essentially, that's what respondent is asking for here, is an inscrutable judgment of the district court when a dispositional departure is granted. And I think that when we are talking about particular amenability to probation, which the Supreme Court has been pretty adamant about, we have to be able to have meaningful independent appellate review. And for that reason we have to have a record. And that simply isn't the case with the question of less onerous than the usual offense here. And again, I think the significance with the omission of the consideration of the fact that the defendant was on felony probation, and moreover for a recently committed felony. That felony was committed within about a year or so of the commission of the offense in question here. The short-term considerations of cooperating with the court and following release conditions and doing some of the things you need to do in a CHIPS case and getting custody of your child returned to you, the CHIPS case, which was necessitated by the defendant's criminal conduct, by the way, that pales in comparison. The analysis I'm asking the court to engage in here is nothing more than the analysis followed by the Supreme Court in Soto, to consider the trog factors, to consider the evidence that the district court pointed to in support of the trog factors, and exercise it, review for an abuse of discretion. And I believe when this court does that, considers the things that the district court considered, and moreover considers the elephant in the living room, the fact that the defendant was on felony probation when he committed this offense, that this court will be left with the distinct impression that a mistake has been made.
And what's the mistake? He got probation when he violated felony probation?
He was given a dispositional departure,
right,
from a mandatory minimum prison sentence under these circumstances. That was the mistake that was made. The district court abused its discretion in that way. Moreover, the question of the less onerous than the usual offense, I think...
And what are these circumstances?
What are these circumstances?
Yeah, I mean, again, as I was, He's 47. Most of his criminal history score was older. He's maintained his sobriety. I mean, what are the circumstances that you would like us to identify that make this clearly an abuse of discretion, outside of he's a felon on probation and he committed a new felony, which obviously, you know, that's serious. I'm not suggesting that's not serious. But what are the circumstances? That he's not been good on probation? That the things I've identified are not true, or what?
I see that my time's expired.
Yes, please answer the question, Mr. Smith.
I think, first of all, the district court was wrong to characterize his criminal history as supporting a departure here. This defendant is no more amenable to probation based on his criminal history, most of which was older, but not isolated, than the defendant was in Soto. That defendant had a significantly less serious criminal history than this defendant does. This defendant's criminal history stretches consistently across decades. Yes, most of it's older. The most serious conviction is from the 90s, a first-degree burglary. But he then has a history of other convictions, including assaults, additional drug convictions, finally culminating in the convictions that bring us here today. So I think that's a substantial factor. I don't think the district court actually relied upon age, and I don't think the defendant's age in this case sets him apart. I think those are substantial issues. And I think, again, as the Supreme Court pointed out in Soto, the cooperation in court and doing what you're ordered to do doesn't overcome those other factors. It's not enough in relationship to the other circumstances to get to that high bar of particular amenability. And for that reason, I would ask this court to reverse the decision of the court of appeal, of the district court, and remand for execution of the mandatory minimum sentence. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Smith. You will have rebuttal. We hear from counsel for the respondent, please.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Amy Lawler. I'm an assistant state public defender, and I represent Frank Quintero in the state sentencing appeal. There are two factual clarifications to the record that must be pointed out. The first is that the district court was absolutely aware of Mr. Quintero's probationary status at the time of the sentencing and indeed referenced it during the sentencing hearing. He noted on page 12 to 13 that Mr. Quintero was on probation in South Dakota at the time of the offense. He noted also the page before in the sentencing hearing on page 11 that Mr. Quintero had stopped a daily 30-year marijuana use habit following that conviction. So the court not only noted the probationary status, but noted what Mr. Quintero had done while he was on probation and implicitly considered whether or not he was complying with the terms of probation as related to that conviction.
Ms. Lawler, I'd like to nail something down. For a dispositional departure, should the court be looking at offense-based related circumstances or offender-based related circumstances?
It can look at both.
Okay. And what case says that?
The Walker, Stempley, and Law cases, as well as, I think, implicitly, the Soto decision, all discuss whether or not the severity of the offense would mean that a dispositional departure would unreasonably depreciate the severity of the offense, or a probationary dispositional departure would unreasonably depreciate the severity of the offense. And so that really goes to the question of whether...
It's a little bit different than saying that a dispositional or a durational departure factor should be considered, isn't it?
I don't think so. I think it really actually goes to how difficult it is to separate the two. But, for example, in Soto, the court said this crime was particularly brutal. So it doesn't matter that he is... might seem particularly amenable to probation, this crime was so brutal that it would unreasonably depreciate the severity of the offense. And so it didn't, you know, on its face, those are two separate factors, but one did play into the other because it doesn't matter how amenable to probation he is if the crime is that bad. But then the converse is also, I think, true. And that's the other factual clarification I wanted to make, which is at page 8 of the sentencing transcript, the state conceded that this crime was less serious than the typical offense, that the possession of one shotgun shell is less serious than possessing many pieces of ammunition, or in particular, possessing a firearm or possessing a firearm with ammunition. And so I think when you look to the offense versus offender-based characteristics, that offense-based consideration matters because it goes to the question of, is this a person who's adopted a life of crime in which he's roaming the streets armed and menacing the public and posing a great danger? Or is this a fairly minor offense that, coupled with all of the other offender-based characteristics, the amenability to programming, the fact that he's maintained his sobriety, the fact that he's maintained employment, the fact that he has completed all of these other courses in accordance with the probationary requirements, those do dovetail together, that this is not a particularly serious crime, and this is someone who is very motivated to change and succeed on probation. And yes, it's not necessarily a clear line. I think that the courts have struggled a little bit to try to keep those two separate when there is so much intersection. But that's what the district court's job is, and that's where the standard of review really comes in, that we have this incredibly deferential abuse of discretion standard because the court is in the best position to gauge the sincerity of the individual standing before him, his level of remorse, his level of cooperation. He's in the best position to weigh the PSI recommendations as well as the recommendations of the state, and the court did that here.
For a downward dispositional departure like this case, is there a difference between an offense-related factor like less serious than usual being the basis for departure as opposed to a factor amongst all factors that the court can consider?
Yes, I do think that there is. I think that we would have a much weaker case if the court had only said that this was a less serious offense than the typical offense, because I think that would then be ignoring any offender-based characteristics and would be ignoring the dovetailing between the two or the intersectionality. Here, the court spent a great deal of time going over all of the offender-based characteristics, really highlighting it, you know, and this is at page 12, 13, 14 of the transcript, the incredible level of cooperation that Mr. Quintero had shown in his deep level of interest in changing, and then highlighted the kind of the mitigated nature of the offense in light of the fact that the state had conceded it was less serious than the typical offense. So yes, it is part of the whole package, and that's
so, Ms. Lohr, what's the evidence that your client was particularly amenable to probation in the record?
Well, besides the use of the magic word, the fact that he'd done everything he was supposed to do on probation, I don't know how else you would
gauge. Except remain law-abiding.
Yes. Well, he's...
God forbid anyone should do that.
But he had remained law-abiding since the arrest. And that's, I think, when you look at the particular
year. Was he in custody?
Well, when he'd gotten out, you know, he did all the things you want to do so many times. And I'm sure everybody who's been on the district court has seen this. Someone will come before them, pledge that they're a changed man, get out, and continue a life that shows anything but
that.
Oh,
I never saw
that.
Everyone complied with every condition of probation I ever imposed.
That's true. That's why my job is so easy. My clients are so, so good at that. And so this particular judge standing, he sees a defendant standing before him and has to gauge, are you saying the right words or are you actually demonstrating it with your actions? And in the months after his arrest and then in the months between the plea and the sentencing, he was. And in fact, he still is. And so the question of, you know, whether or not the court was wrong, the court pointed to every factor that it had in front of it in terms of programming and being law-abiding since the offense. And I think also really delved into the nature of the offense. You know, you really opened yourself up to letting people stay in your house when those people had drug problems. You have to stop that. And he did. And I don't know what else the state wants the court to do. The court here actually made far more thorough findings than you would see in most cases in terms of really highlighting in detail the types of programming that Mr. Quintero had done, making specific references to the PSI, his conduct in the CHIPS case, having read over the defendant's sentencing memorandum, you know, making references to that. This is a thorough record, unlike many others that you might see where a court might very offhandedly say, yep, he's amenable to probation in light of a plea agreement or something along those lines. This is a case where the plea agreement specifically allowed for this downward dispositional departure, and he made very thorough findings in order to highlight that.
Can you explain for me, Ms. Lawler, the significance of the 42% departure rate of the district courts, I guess, throughout Minnesota with respect to this particular offense.
And I think that goes to the question of whether or not a downward dispositional departure unreasonably depreciates the seriousness of the offense. And I would argue that that percentage number just goes to show that it doesn't, that this is not the type of case that as a whole the bench has decided is so serious and so onerous that to downward depart dispositionally is unreasonable or somehow.
But we don't know from those 42% what cases might have been appealed by the state, if any. We have no idea based on your statistics.
That's correct. And I imagine a number of them were simply plea agreements to a downward dispositional departure because implicit in that was that the state and the defense had reached an agreement that this wasn't a particularly bad crime. But
do you think it also reflects discomfort with the law itself, that it's the legislature's prerogative to decide the sentence for a particular violation?
Well, I think it's more that it shows that the bench is taking advantage of an exception that the legislature specifically wrote into 60911 subdivision 8. It's clear there not only that a downward dispositional departure is allowed, but it even specifically allows it on the court's own motion. So I think it actually goes to show that the legislature recognized that this can be a very gray area and that there's a world of difference between a single shotgun shell and an armed and dangerous criminal who's out roaming the streets with a loaded gun, and specifically allowed a great deal of discretion both with the parties and with the court in its sentencing decisions.
I think there's a danger, though, in in considering statistics like that, because what it doesn't take into account is that, you know, the vast majority of the cases come out of the metro area. That's what's driving the statistics. My guess is if you did that same quantification on cases coming from rural Minnesota, you're not looking at 42%. So I think it's a bit of an overreach to claim that that statistic somehow is support for the argument that departures with the, you know, involving this crime are, or that it should be considered in making those considerations. I just think, you know, the vast majority of cases, numbers-wise, population-wise, comes out of the metro area, and my guess is you're probably looking at about a 5% departure rate if you did those same numbers in rural Minnesota. So that's why I don't, to me, that's not persuasive. Whether the judge did the right thing here or not, that's a separate issue. But I don't find this percentage argument at all persuasive, personally.
Well, I don't think you need to for us to win, thank goodness. But I think the reason it matters most is in response to the argument that this was more serious than the typical offense. And maybe that doesn't matter at all. Maybe we don't need to even reach the nature of the offense if we look only at offender-based characteristics. And there's certainly room to affirm just based on the district court's findings in that regard. But if the court were to reach the question of whether this is more serious than the typical offense, I think you have to weigh the state's own admission that it wasn't on page 8 of the sentencing transcript, as well as the fact that when you have those types of numbers with the departure, one shotgun shell cannot be more serious than the 42% of other cases that receive downward dispositional departures in light of the specific findings that this court made and in light of the state's concession that it was not more serious than the typical offense. And then you also compare that to decisions like Soto, where inherently a first-degree criminal sexual conduct case that involves the use of force is a brutal crime. And that's just not the type of crime that's at issue here. If the court has no further questions,
thank you,
would ask the court to affirm. Thank you.
Mr. Smith, you'll have the last word, sir.
We've continued to spend a lot of time talking about whether this offense is more or less serious than the usual offense. And I think what is really kind of disturbing about this whole thing is that, first of all, it requires the court to at the very least imagine, if not provide evidence for what is the usual offense. I don't think the statistics from the Guidelines Commission bear at all on that question.
You know, under these facts, and perhaps I'm wrong, but, you know, a kid brought it. Would it be fair to say that the facts indicate that some child brought the shotgun shell to him and then he put it in some shed or something?
That's the defendant's contention.
That does sound different than, you know, buying a shotgun shell from a gun, you know, from an illegal gun dealer or, you know, going out of your way to get the, you know, to get shotgun shells so you can load your shotguns so you can rob the liquor store. I mean, in all candor, this does seem to me less onerous than a typical, or one that I would expect to see, which is, you know, criminals doing criminal things so they can do more criminal things, you know.
And certainly I recognize the sort of emotive narrative appeal of that, but I think it's important when we stop to consider things like the Johnson decision from the United States Supreme Court, where we're talking about the categorical approach in the Armed Career Offender Act, which required the court to imagine what the typical offense was to determine whether it was a violent crime. And that approach is unconstitutional. And so I don't think that we should engage in this sort of exercise of judicial imagination, which is what the U.S. Supreme Court described it as, to determine whether a particular violation of the statute is more or less serious than the typical offense. I think that's a very problematic approach from a perspective of due process.
Well, and in this case, we're talking about a dispositional departure to which those kinds of factors aren't supposed to directly relate. Why wouldn't we, in discerning the district court's use of its discretion, focus really on the other points that the court identified?
And that's exactly my position, is that this case really has to rise or fall on the finding of particular amenability. I believe, one, that the record is absolutely inadequate to determine whether this particular violation of this statute, which was committed along with two other crimes of violence as defined by the very statute we're asking about here, was more or less serious than the usual case.
Except at sentencing, you or whoever was there for the state acknowledged it was less onerous.
Certainly, the trial prosecutor did acknowledge that fact, but I think there's two important principles there. First, the question of durational departure, which is what the prosecutor said that was relevant to, wasn't before the district court. So that concession was immaterial to any litigated issue. Second, as this court and the Supreme Court have repeatedly pointed out, the party's agreement that a basis for a departure exists is not sufficient. There must be a factual record to justify the departure. And that's because the district court has to conduct an independent review of the facts to ensure that a departure is appropriate, and the appellate courts must be able to conduct meaningful review of the decision of the district court to depart in order to fulfill the purposes of the sentencing guidelines, which are consistency, predictability, and rationality in sentencing. So the prosecutor's seeming concession there, I don't think gets us much of anywhere. That's my position, that it's not a litigated issue, and therefore I'm not stuck with that. And moreover, the appellate courts have repeatedly said that the party's agreement that a basis for a departure exists isn't sufficient to create the basis for a departure. I also want to point out that the legislature's judgment, its considered policy judgment, is that the possession of any ammunition by someone who has prior convictions for crimes of violence justifies a prison sentence, an executed prison sentence. And the structure of 60911 subdivision 5 demonstrates this. Rather than supporting respondents' contention that his crime was less serious than the typical offense, the statute actually undermines it. It treats the mere possession of firearms or ammunition in any amount, in any kind, by people who have been convicted of crimes of violence as equally serious and justifying an executed prison sentence. Accordingly, for this reason and for all of the other reasons I've articulated, the district court erred when it departed from the mandatory minimum, and I would ask this court to reverse. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Thank you, Ms. Lawler. The matter is submitted.